We were studying Ecclesiastes. We were in chapter 5 Wednesday night, the beginning of the chapter, discussing the reverence of God. And we were going through in verses 4 through 7 of chapter 5, discussing why to keep our vows to God. We got a little sidetracked with discussing vows to other people, but with the context, this whole section was reverence to God. And so with that in view, we're looking at just specifically our vows to God. And we looked at the different types of vows there are. Why would someone make a vow to God? We read in these scriptures, I guess out of section 3 here, that someone might make a vow to God out of praise, or out of thanksgiving, thankfulness, or also out of a petition or request for something that they desire. Make a vow: I'll do this for me, and I'll do this for you, Lord. And of course, we know that reading the scriptures, once a vow is made, it must be kept. And that's why in these verses we are seeing in verse 2 of chapter 5, don't be rash with your mouth. Don't utter anything hastily before God. And in verse 4 through 7, I'll go ahead and read it since we're picking up there. It says, when you make a vow to God, do not delay to pay it, for he has no pleasure in fools. Pay what you have vowed. Better not to vow than to vow and not pay. Do not let your mouth cause your flesh to sin, nor say before the messenger of God that it was an error. Why should God be angry at your excuses and destroy the work of your hands? For in the multitude of dreams and many words there is also vanity, but fear God. Do you need a lesson, Sally?
Yes. I'm missing a cover.
Yeah, I'm missing.
Here you go.
Part of one.
Okay, it's me.
That's the staple malfunction. Once you made a vow, the vow needs to be kept. And we know this in what Moses was telling the Israelites back in Numbers chapter 30. Numbers 30, beginning in verse 2. If a man makes a vow to the Lord, or swears an oath to bind himself by some agreement, he shall not break his word. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth. And also in Deuteronomy 23. Verse 21. When you make a vow to the Lord your God, you shall not delay to pay it, for the Lord your God will surely require it of you, and it would be sin to you. But if you abstain from vowing, it shall not be sin to you. That which has gone from your lips you shall keep and perform. For you voluntarily vowed to the Lord your God what you have promised with your mouth. We see here, it's not just, I'm going to do this. It's a matter of keeping all that you perform. Whatever it is that you've uttered, you have to meet that full obligation, all that you have spoken. We're not required to vow, but if you do it voluntarily, you better keep it. And what are the consequences if we don't? If we utter something and we don't do it, or don't meet it to the full measure of what we've spoken, we'll receive God's anger.
We're cursed.
Yeah, we'll be cursed. That's in Malachi. Any other answers? Sorry? Yeah, it's a sin. God will be angry. Of course, God's angry with sin. He'll get angry with us. He'll curse us. You look at...
Verse 6 says, and destroy the work of your hands.
Yes, correct. That's the other part I was looking for. Destroy the work of our hands. And in 5, in the end of 6, it says, God will be angry with your excuse and destroy the work of your hands. And of course, here we're reading, this bit's in Ecclesiastes. In Ecclesiastes, we're dealing with what part of human life?
Under the sun.
Yeah, everything under the sun. We're not dealing with anything after, with immortality. We're dealing with just man here on earth. And so this destroy the work of your hands, that could, that's probably the an imminent judgment on you now. If, you know, we're talking about all these times about possessing and gaining is what we do here on earth. God is angry with you. Take that all away right here and now. An immediate judgment. And of course we know, you know, when we go outside of that context, that yeah, sin will be judged for that in after. It will affect the rest of our immortality. Turn to Malachi chapter 1:14. It says, but in verse 14, Malachi 1 says, that cursed be the deceiver who has in his flock a male and takes a vow, and but sacrifices to the Lord what is blemished. For I am a great king, says the Lord of hosts. My name is to be feared among the nations. And we also look back in Ecclesiastes in the end of verse 7. It says, in multitude of dreams and many words there is vanity, but fear God. So what attitude will ensure that we keep our vows?
Reverence
to God, fear of God. You know, the realization that, like when we read Malachi, God is a great king. He's to be honored. We read, I think, in the last chapter, which talked about how, that wasn't the last chapter, that was just in section 2. God is in heaven, we're on earth. He's greater than us, He's mightier than us, He's more knowledgeable than us. In all things, God is superior. And we need to fear Him and have reverence for Him. You know, to say, you know, even amongst those around you, you tell them you're going to do something, you don't do it, showing disrespect to your neighbor. You do it to God, and you're disrespecting God, not an intelligent thing.
Mm-hmm. God's all-knowing, omniscient. He knows our motives. He knows why we do things and why we don't do things. And mm-hmm. I was thinking about this time of year, a lot of people this time of year, and Christmas, that's all that's in my new worship, or quote worship. And God sees this. It's very vain worship, and He's not going to accept that. He wants to worship the same truth and spirit.
That's right. Yeah, it's important to realize that, yeah, always remember that God can read our hearts. He knows why we do the things we do, and when we fail to do them, as in this case, He knows why we're doing it. And He'll judge us accordingly. In whichever way you look at that, here on earth or in the hereafter. And I wanted to see if that part. Of course, I didn't cover earlier about when you know, vows, maybe I did Wednesday night, just when someone vows, it could be anything. I mean, we know when we look at the Old Testament, oh, a vow is a sacrifice to the Lord. We think of sacrifice in the Old Testament is the giving of animals. Like in Malachi, we see one of the flock. But it's not necessarily, you know, it's not limited to a sacrifice of an animal to God. It can be anything. It could be animals. It could be, you could vow or promise, you know, a people or land. I don't remember the verse. I didn't put it in here. But there's a section that how it deals with the land that you've promised to God, how it is promised, and what becomes of it. And so anything can be vowed to the Lord. And I have a few examples here. If you turn to Judges, of just I guess this is an example both of a vow, but also when we're looking at these, we're talking about being hasty with our lips and make a rash vow. This first one is an example of just that, a rash vow. This is chapter 11, verse 30. And Jephthah made a vow to the Lord. He said, if you will indeed deliver the people of Ammon into my hands, then it will be that whatever comes out of the doors of my house to meet me, when I return in peace from the people of Ammon, shall surely be the Lord's, and I will offer it up as a burnt offering. And, of course, what kind of vow is he making here?
Rash. What?
But it's a rash. I guess specifically, what are those three we listed?
Thanksgiving.
Is it a thing of Thanksgiving?
Third offering. Offering.
Well, yeah, he's giving an offering, but I mean.
Petition.
A request. See, Thanksgiving is something you're thankful for already, and here he's saying, he hadn't received it yet, and I don't know, maybe he's trying to praise. I think it's a petition of Christ. He's saying, grant Amnon into my hand, give me victory, and I'll give you whatever comes out of my door. And that's, that statement is what undoes him, because that's pretty general, pretty nonspecific, pretty rash. We'll see in verse 34 and 35, when Jephthah came to his house at Mizpah, there was his daughter coming out to meet him with timbrels and dancing, and she was his only child. Besides her, he had neither son nor daughter. And it came to pass when he saw her that he tore his clothes and said, "Alas, my daughter, you have brought me very low. You are among those who trouble me, for I have given my word to the Lord, and I cannot go back on it." So his daughter is what came out to meet him first. And by his vow, he's upheld to sacrifice her. And in 39, he does. And it was so at the end of 2 months, she turned to her father and carried out his vow with which he had vowed. She knew no man, and it became a custom of Israel. Well, it had to do with he let her go off in the wilderness for a while. Anyway, but he made a rash vow. He knew he couldn't go back on it, and he kept his vow, even at the cost of his own only daughter, his only child. He had that proper respect, that reverence of God, knowing, you know, the outcome if he didn't keep the vow he had made. And I'm sure we know he regretted it. He regretted it as soon as she came out, but no take back since. In 1 Samuel, verse 11. It has to do with Hannah, the wife of Elkanah. And 11, she didn't have any children, and she made a vow and said, "O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your maidservant and remember me, and not forget your maidservants, but will give your maidservant a male child, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and no razor shall come upon his head." And again, what kind of vow do we see here?
Petition.
She's making a request of God. And this one, I wouldn't classify it as a rash vow. She knew what she was doing out of the torment of her heart. But the important part is she maintained her vow when it came to pass. In verse 20. Just so it, I'm using the same words as the scripture. So it came to pass in a process of time that Hannah conceived and bore a son, and called his name Samuel, saying, "Because I have asked for him from the Lord." And then down in 27, she took him to the Lord. "For this child I prayed, and the Lord has granted me my petition, which I have asked of him. Therefore, I also have lent him to the Lord. As long as he lives, he shall be lent to the Lord." So they worshiped the Lord there in the temple. So, this woman, she made this vow for a child. And when it came to pass, she kept her vow to God, which meant giving up her child to the Lord. And this was her first and only at the time. But she kept it. And it's just important to see examples of that faith, of that reverence to God, that respect for God, fear of God, that, you know, even in the face of, you know, something you don't like, if you vowed it, they maintained their vows, they kept to them. The examples of dedication to God. And of course, we know after this, her child didn't die. She saw her child once a year, but still, only once a year is very little for your firstborn child. Difficult situation. A lot of people now could make that vow, and then when it comes to pass, say, "And, you know, he doesn't really want to give up my child, even though I said I would. You know, doesn't have a mother or father living with, you know, the priests, I guess." A lot of people might turn back on what they said. But it's folly.
I don't know if it's exactly the same now, but I was thinking about in the lesson that people today, when they get in dire circumstances, or maybe also more in health, because I can relate to that, you think more of God, obviously, because you're praying to Him, you want, but they'll say things, you know, oh, I'm going to do this or that, worship God, I'm gonna, but do we do it? Is that real, or is that just the moment we need God and then we forget about it?
Yeah.
That's something that happens, you know, you see that.
And then that's a lack of faith and reverence to God, to never pay attention to Him until you're in trouble and then got no way out, so no one's there to help you. So they turn to God then, and then when things get better, whatever, forget everything they said. they don't meet that obligation, whatever it is. I think there was, you know, probably a lot of that occurring back in after 9/11, when a lot of people died, a lot of people became fervent for the Lord again, and, you know, I don't know what everyone said, but that didn't last too long.
Thank you, Lord's not that way towards us.
Yeah. Any questions on that section? That section was a little different. We've been talking about this section of chapter 1 through 6 was about observations of life, and that one sort of was and wasn't. It's a little different. But he comes back to that in chapter 5 verse 8. Back to observations of life, back to the vanity of life. He's discussing the effects of coveting riches. And in verse 8 through 9, talks about oppression, which we've read about before. In verse 8, if you see the oppression of the poor and the violent perversion of justice and righteousness in a province, do not marvel at the matter, for high official watches over high official, and higher officials are over them. Moreover, the profit of the land is for all, even the king is served from the field. Now, I don't know, does anyone have the other translation that doesn't use the term high official, but forgot what it used? I guess not.
One official.
Official. There was another translation I read that's talking about sort of, it left out the term official and left it just higher, governing authorities higher than these.
In the footnote in the New American Standard, it just says high one.
Yeah, high one. So mine gives the idea of, and I think it's true, the context that high official is someone here on earth. The high one could be misinterpreted, or could be interpreted as, you know, angelic forces and God, ultimately, where it talks about the higher over them all. But we're just talking about oppression on earth. And what type of oppression do we think we're seeing here? It says the poor are oppressed, the violent perversion of justice. That could, you know, occur in a lot of different ways.
A lot of powers that have the ability to arrest and twist the judgments towards
themselves. I guess yours has the resting text. I know mine has in the footnote, in place of the violent perversion, is resting. The resting of justice. And when you look up resting, it's not a word we use a lot, it's to pull or force or move by violent twisting movements, to gain by difficulty or as if by force, violence, or determined labor. And to me, that shows it. It gives a signification. And, you know, you see two children resting over a toy. It's showing something's being forcefully taken. They're sitting there jerking and twisting until one gets it. Got it. It's mine. This is being taken from the poor. And we see in verse 9, you know, the profit of the land, to be served by the field, is the idea of production of valuables, of riches. Everything we have is derived from the land, you know, the resources of the land, which is why America is so rich. We have very many resources, a great deal of land, which consists of, you know, food comes from the land, rare metals, gems, building materials, you know, wood, stone, metal, all of those things are the resources of the land. And yet, all those things are always limited. They're always of a finite quantity, which is why we consider things valuable. the rocks that are everywhere aren't valuable because they're everywhere. Everyone can get a rock. But things that are of a finite quantity, not everyone can get them. So they have value, and that leads to oppression for resting, for you know, trying to get these from one another, taking them from one another. And we see here that in verse 8, it says, you know, you see this oppression, but don't marvel at the matter. Of course, marvel is, you know, intense surprise, wonder, and astonishment. Why shouldn't we marvel? Why shouldn't we be surprised that this occurs?
Because it's a normal thing under the sun.
Yeah, it is a normal thing under the sun. We've seen that, in, I think, in verse chapter 4. Everyone sees oppression. Experienced or not, everyone sees it. It happens here regularly. We shouldn't be shocked by it. We still get angry by it. What else in the passage talks about why?
System. And so the system, the world that we live in, the nature of the life under the sun, that's the way people, the world of people are. Choose to operate that way. And there's, you know, there's just shouldn't be surprising because we see it all the time. And yet they're not going to, you know, they don't ultimately gain by it. But it is, as he says, a total different verse than 9. And the New American Standard 9, the way you were reading, it is, from the standpoint of the king, a system. Although we don't like it particularly, and it is not just, it avoids, in effect, avoids anarchy. I mean, it is a system that works, like it or not.
Yeah. Yeah. That's our system. Did you have a comment? No, I'll sit. Rocky?
It's interesting here recently, Alan Greenspan was being interviewed about this economy, about everything the government's doing to what's happening with the economy, and the commentator was asking him about it. And now Greenspan says, well, you're going to have another cycle like this. And the reason why he attributed to that was because of human nature. In other words, it was greed. And just part of life. And unfortunately, people can avoid that, but because of human nature and sin and greed, we have these cycles.
Yeah. It's unavoidable. That's why we see it all the time. Because this is the system we live in. Like I said, these limited resources are there. Everyone's going to fight for them. And, you know, the officials all the way to the top are, you know, fed by this, by the bottom. You know, the higher official, like we have, you know, everyone has the same system, even though we have different, you know, political, you know, governing designs. There's still taxes, and the president's salary is paid by our taxes. Now, of course, their systems are a little different. The higher officials all the way at the top, you know, like. When you read in the New Testament about the publicans and the tax collectors, why did everyone hate them so much? Besides the fact they just had to give them money.
Because they took more than what was actually owed.
Yeah.
They wrested it from
people. Yeah, they wrested it from people. They had a quota to meet, and sure they got their quota, they a lot of times took a lot of more, or may take more than was required. Make sure that they have, you know, enough for themselves, enough to pass up to the guy ahead of him, and on up the chain all the way up to the time of Jesus to Caesar, the Roman authorities. And of course, you know, even if those men were just and just taking just the right amount, people probably still wouldn't like them. Because they're still taking something you worked for. But that's the system we live in. The king is served by the land. You know, even the littlest man, he's serving the king in what he does. King's not out, you know, doing his own fields. It all goes close to the top. And as soon as someone gets covetous, you know, these are the effects of riches. They get covetous, they get greedy, and then they start taking more than what is fair. But that's the way it is. We shouldn't marvel about it. We got to live with it.
You know, Michael, one of the things, although we're always talking about things under the sun, every time we read something like this, I'm reminded that of 1 John, the idea of lest we have, lest the flesh sin will cry of light. You start to look at how these things are operating, these things of the world. These are the things of the world, and that's, we're living in the midst of that. Mm-hmm. So, again, don't marvel, it's just the way it happens.
This is the world, and of course, we know that it is vanity. The vanity to seek after, seek riches. They're not profitable in the end. But you know, we shouldn't get worked up about this. It's all futility. And another effect of riches in verse 10 through 12, you see discontent. And in verse 10, he who loves silver would not be satisfied with silver, nor he who loves abundance with increase. This also is vanity. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. So what profit have the owners except to see them with their eyes? The sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eats little or much. But the abundance of the rich will not permit him to sleep. And so, of course, when we see verse 10, if you love silver, not be satisfied with silver, or with abundance. And it is this idea of discontent, of covetousness. You know, you can gain riches and gain riches, and they're not going to satisfy. And just to note, you know, we've seen the same thing in Luke 12, in verse 15, where you know, it's talking about the rich man, the parable of the rich man. It says, "Don't seek for, you know, the riches of this earth alone." And also in 1 Timothy 6, 8 through 9. In verse 8 of Timothy 6, "Having food and clothing, with these we shall be content. But those who desire to be rich fall in temptations and snares, and in many foolish and harmful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition." In other words, we know this is going outside the context, you know, it draws you into sinful nature, which ultimately destroys you. But that's in the next life. Just within this life, you know, we know it's vanity. And why is that?
You never have enough. More.
Why doesn't it satisfy?
That's it, because you want more.
Yeah, so
it's
more.
Always destined with this, and it never ends. It's why we talk to a cycle. In fact, there's just countries in it. It's just more. It's greed causes you to have that problem of wanting more. You're never satisfied, because you're never going to want. Be happy with that. It's just never ending cycle. More.
So, yeah. Says Mr. and Mrs. Jones down the street got new car.
So
it
yeah.
Comes down to it's
because
you want
what
your neighbors
have. That's covetousness, right? Jealousy.
Mm-hmm. The other thing you run into, I think, in verse 11, kind of in that direction, that the things go up, you get them, you gain, and what happens? Everybody around you wants a little bit of the action, whether it's your family or these people who win the lottery. You hardly, I don't know if you ever hear anybody that's happy after we win a lot. Because, yeah. You know, it's like they come out of the woodwork. People come in, want a piece of the action.
Yeah.
Those who consume them, consume and increase. So you just stand by and watch it.
Yeah.
And can't enjoy it.
You can look at that in two ways. And when you have more people, like you said, gather around you to consume it. And so you're not increasing your store, if you want to call it, or the amount you have is just getting consumed more quickly. But, you know, also, you can lay out just, you know, even if it's not others coming to consume it, just within yourself, you know, we have the quality of life they talk about in America, the standard of living, how it increases over time. But that's not because other people are consuming your stuff, it's because you're just, as you get more, you use more. And, you know, it's, you know, a lot of times people say, oh, if I got a raise, then I'd be able to save up for my son's college, and I can get you know, a bit more in the bank to keep me safe or whatever. And people get that raise, and what do? They don't save up anymore. They just start using more, and in the same spot they were in. They're not saving any more than that they were, even though they're making more. They get a bigger house, and that requires it has a bigger note. And they get a better car, or they go out to eat more. And why? Well, because we can now. You just, you know, that's the way it is. It's easier to move up. It's a lot easier to just kind of slip up like that than it is to back down. And that's one of a lot of things difficulties we're seeing now during our recession, the slowdown. We don't like moving backwards.
Also, I think in the terms almost as in the sense of goals, it's because you've said, I want to get to this, and that'll make me happy. But once you get to that, then just like everything in business, then once you've met that quota, then there's goals. They increase what the goal is.
Yeah, that's what we were talking about earlier. Just, you know, that's the essence of greed is more and more and more. You get there and, well, here's the next projection. Let's go for that one. Rocky?
Mike, because of this issue, I think it's so important for us, the children of God, to we have so much admonition in the New Testament about when we pray, have this prayer attitude of thanksgiving, you know, that we don't fall in this trap of not being content with what we have. And we always want more and more, consider the things that we have, and have the spirit of thanksgiving, and just recognize that all we have comes from the hand of God, and be very thankful for what we do have. And sometimes we always look ahead, but look back and see what we do have.
And we're going to get to exactly that here in a minute. The recommendation the preacher lives in view of all of this. we see this seeking the riches is vanity. It says so. And you know, we saw why, because you know, poof, it's gone as soon as it gets here. We'll also look at, that was 11, but I want to look at Proverbs 23. Ecclesiastes 11, we saw, it increases. Those who consume them increases. You never get the gain you were looking for. But in Proverbs 23, the same thought, verse 4 through 5. Do not overwork to be rich, because of your own understanding cease. You set your eyes on that which is not. For riches certainly make themselves wings. They fly away like an eagle toward heaven. And it's that same thought, you know. But you know, I guess you can apply it in lots of different ways. Yeah, you just consume it, they're gone. So we've also read, shall we start to get there? Yeah, we've also read in chapter 4 how, you know, there was one hoarding, gaining, gathering, and then something happened. Oh, it's gone. There it went. You know, it didn't even, I think that was in chapter 4. Yeah, you know, we've seen, you know, you gather up, you gain, and for what? You die. It goes to somebody else. It goes to an inheritance to someone else who may or may not deserve it. It's all futility. It's all vanity. And one other point here before we move on, and it talks about between the poor man and the rich man, and the sleep they get. Why can't the rich man sleep? Yeah, he might never sleep because he's just never happy.
Worry about holding on to God.
Yeah, he might be worrying about maintaining what he has. He's not content, so that maybe drives him and irritates him, or just the, maybe I got to hold on to what I do have, the worrisome, the stress of it. Is it? It's not about because he has enough. He's overly full, and he just can't sleep because he just got so much, right? We don't see that here, do we? I know I can't sleep, but I eat too much. That's not the case. When we look at the poor man, not the poor man, the laboring man, his sleep is sweet, regardless of how much he eats, or whether it's little or whether it's much. He's content. Whether he has a little, whether he has a lot, he's content, and he goes to sleep, and he doesn't have to, he's not worrying, he's not in this state of discontent, driving him to worry about what he has, or what about worrying about trying to gain more. The hoarding. Does anyone have comments in that section? Small section? So it's, you know, don't desire to possess. It's futile. But then we further see this in beginning of verse 13 through 17. 13. There is a severe evil which I have seen under the sun. Riches kept for their owner to his hurt. But those riches perish through misfortune. When he begets a son, there is nothing in his hand. As he came from his mother's womb, naked he shall return, to go as he came. And he shall take nothing from his labor, with which he may carry away in his hand. This also is a severe evil. Just exactly as he came, so he shall go. And what profit has he who has labored for the wind? All his days he also eats in darkness. He has much sorrow and sickness and anger. And so I guess in the beginning of this, I call it the discomfort to hoard. You know, the idea of being too frugal or stingy, I guess even with yourself. In verse 13 he says he kept these riches to his own hurt. So this guy has riches, he's gathered them up, and in doing so he's hurt himself. He's hoarding it from himself to gather them, to guard them, to keep them. And what ultimately becomes of his riches? Well, yeah, I don't think the son gets it in this one. But I think that was back in chapter 2, we saw the inheritance. Chapter 3.
He lost it because he invested badly.
Yeah, he lost it because he invested badly. Mine uses the term misfortune, and the footnote also says bad business. Now here, we've seen this guy, he's hoarding, he's gathering, he's still working to get it. He's one of these guys who's not satisfied with what he has. And yeah, people invest the money in the hopes of gaining more, and this investment didn't work out. It's gone. He has nothing. He has a son, but he has nothing for his son. No one has anything.
This really relates to me because my grandfather had hundreds and thousands of dollars in the stock market recently, and now it's almost done to nothing, and he's worried over it because now he has nothing to give us. Unfortunately, he's not a Christian, but his principle is now he can't give much to my dad because he's lost it through bad investment, and it worries him over and over.
Yeah. It's not something to worry about, is it? I guess, ultimately, what's the outcome? Even if he had it, I guess if he wants to pass it on, then that's good. But I mean, what profit was there in it? It's minimal profit.
I mean, this greed causes your mind not to be able to put things in the right perspective or focus, because you don't know what's enough. I mean, God's given us so much, and if you just want more and more, as you stated, you're never satisfied, and you don't realize you have enough. In fact, most Siskin is more than they know what to do with. And yet, we're also poor, we're also broke. What does that tell God? And it's something somebody else means we're not thankful for what we do have. Mm-hmm. And it distorts your view.
Perception. Yeah.
Perception, exactly.
Not discontent with what you do have. We have a great deal in this country. So we see what profit was gained by this hoarding of the riches. I think they already know. Yeah, none. He didn't gain any profit. He didn't get anything out of it. We do see and I mentioned before, and we've seen it over and over throughout Ecclesiastes. As you come, so shall you go. You focus your life on this, and you're not taking anything with you. It's all left behind. It's all for naught. You come and then you perish and you die. And whether you lose it while you're still here, or you lose it when you pass away, you're going to lose it. So don't get upset about it. It's inevitable. There's no profit in it. But we do see something more this guy did get. It wasn't profitable. What did he gain by laboring for the wind here in the very last verse? Well, in verse 17, what became of him?
He ate from darkness and had great
vexation,
sickness, and anger.
Yeah, it's not a. You got something, but we wouldn't call it profitable, would we?
The spirit. I was thinking about David's point is.
It's you can look at it in different ways. In some sense, I mean, all of it's really sort of this disturbance by the whole, the effect of it all. He's disturbed. He's vexed. It's a bitterness here. He spent his time hoarding and gaining to his own hurt. He didn't even enjoy it, and then it's gone. He always, with hindsight, is 20/20. You stop, and now you're looking back. Man, I got nothing. You look back. Wow, I had a bunch. Man, if I had done this, if I had done that, maybe if I had done this, I wouldn't have lost it. If I had done this, at least I enjoyed it. Maybe I would be better off as you look back on how I enjoyed it. But now here I am. I didn't enjoy any of it. Now I got nothing to enjoy anyway. It's just a bitterness of spirit. The outcome of this, his sorrow, anger, he dwells on his loss, and that's not going to get any profit either, is it? It's just, I know they say, the stress and anxiety sometimes, that does, I think they medically say it does cause sickness. You're just going to set yourself on a path to destroy yourself faster than what is going to eventually happen anyway. So it's all vanity, it's all futility. And you can increase your futility just dwelling on the fact of your loss. You just accept it and go on, that the loss is inevitable. So what's the outcome? What does the author suggest we should do? Out of all this we've seen, of all this vanity in life, in 18 through 20, it says, here's what I have seen. It is good and fitting for one to eat and drink and to enjoy the good of all his labor in which he toils under the sun, all the days of his life, which God gives him, for it is his heritage. As for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth, and given him power to eat of it, to receive his heritage and rejoice in his labor, it is the gift of God. For he will not dwell unduly on the days of his life, because God keeps him busy with the joy of his heart. And so you see, we're given riches by God to enjoy them. Not for hoarding them, not for, it's not a matter of to satisfy, look how big my bank account is. You focus on that, you'll never be satisfied. Just to use them to satisfy your desires, to eat and drink and fulfill your appetite. It's the only thing you can really use them for, to get any, we don't want to call it profit, but it's because it's so temporary, so fleeting, but it's better than anything else, really. We see that here. This is better than any other options you have. Now, we've seen the same recommendation several times previously. I had a question of if anyone can remember what verses, what chapters we've seen those in.
3:22.
Yes, 3:22, 3:12, 2:24. We see it again here the fourth time. It's the recommendation the preacher, that Solomon makes over and over again. In life, nothing is profitable, it's all futility. If there's anything to be gained, this is it. And we can't call it a true gain, because we know it's fleeting, we know it, ultimately it's vanity, but it's better than anything else. And you can increase sorrows the other way. And I guess in each of these instances, in chapter 2 and chapter 3, an explanation is given of why this is the case. And why is the case in each of these instances? I guess one, we know it's better, but why should we follow it?
God's wisdom.
What's that?
It's just God's wisdom.
God's will?
Wisdom.
Yeah, God's wisdom.
We have someone here to try everything. And from his wisdom of under the sun, he had
the ability and the wealth to
try all these things. Mm-hmm. And he says, this is good. This is the only good you're going to get out of these things.
Wow. That's all true. And that's how we come to that conclusion. But specifically, I was looking for each of these verses. It says it's the gift of God. Mm-hmm. This is the gift of God, and he's given it to us. We might as well use it.